thank you to our next guest, Heather Mitcheltree. Thank you so much for agreeing to come to the podcast at a very last moment during your quick flying visit to Cyprus. I know that you're only here for about 15 minutes.
Slightly longer than that, but yes, it's a short trip.
No, but thank you so much for taking the time to meet with me and record this podcast. As soon as I saw that you're on the island, my mind started spinning. I'm like, I've got to get her to do a podcast for various reasons. One, you're an Australian, so that's a giveaway why I'm interested in you. Second, you're doing some very interesting work in the buffer zone of Cyprus, one of the themes of the podcast. I won't explain to the listeners what you do. Let's dive straight into this. Let's start with back when we first met a few years ago. That was back around 2019, pre-pandemic, when the world was a different place. You had come here to do some scanning in the buffer zone as part of your PhD, your studies, I should say.
So the scanning in the buffer zone was actually part of my work at Melbourne University.
Right, yep.
So it was a little bit of a project of love that Mitchell Ransom and I, so a colleague at Melbourne University, set up, where we were granted access to select parts of the buffer zone.
Mm-hmm.
And we brought in 3D scanning equipment over multiple trips to Cyprus. So I think 2019 we had four or five trips to Cyprus that year to do scanning of select sites. And also on one of the trips, we brought a bunch of students with us who were doing a design studio looking specifically at Nicosia and Cyprus. And we were able to scan a range of different sites across those four trips.
Yeah. It's a different world when you talk about bringing students over. I think ever since 2020, the idea of more than one person traveling was such a foreign concept still. I'm still readjusting to the new realities of ability to move and do things. So, okay, so back in 2019, first of all, let's take a couple steps back. Why Cyprus? What drew your attention to Cyprus? I mean, living in Melbourne, yeah, sure, there's some Cypriots in Melbourne, but what triggered your knowledge of Cyprus?
Well, I had come over a couple of years earlier with my children to visit family that we have here. So my sister-in-law works with the United Nations and their cousin is here as well. So it was a family visit as part of a broader trip around Europe. I had never been to Nicosia, and I have to confess, did not know a whole lot about Nicosia or Cyprus.
Well, you must be the only person I've ever met that doesn't know what Nicosia is.
at the time. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, when I arrived, I was just blown away by the wonderful cultural heritage that you have across the entirety of the island, but particularly within Nicosia, within the old city, the old walled city, and then the spatial condition that has arisen because of the protracted conflict and divide, and how that has shaped the morphology of the urban context, as well as the response to cultural heritage that happens on either side of that buffer divide and within it.
It's interesting as a non-stakeholder to Cyprus, whether it's non-stakeholder because you don't have ancestry from here, you don't live here, you don't work here. Well, you technically work here when you come to this, but you can see Cyprus neutrally.
Yeah.
You can see the space. You can see the physical nature of it. You can see the buffer zone for what it is without the emotion that gets carried by locals.
Yeah.
I won't say that you're apathetic. Obviously, you're not. But it's one thing to be a Cypriot, be it Greek or Turkish Cypriot, Armenian, Maronite, Latin, whatever, to look at the buffer zone versus an outsider looking at it. You can see it for what it is, its potential, and its loss. So in 2019, when you first started scanning, what were your first impressions? Not talking about the political realm, but your first impression of the actual buffer zone, the reality of it. What was your first impressions of that?
So it's a really fascinating space of contradictions within the buffer zones. You have, in one sense, this sort of amazing preservation of what was as a sort of point in time preservation, but you also have the degradation that's happened over time because of the elements and vegetation coming in. So whilst there's a preservation of the architecture as it was during the initial moment of division, that's also eroding. And we really felt that there was an important sense to be able to capture that, because yep. even from one trip to the next, we noticed that there were buildings that had fallen down mm-hmm. or facades that had come away. 2019, there were some fairly heavy rains.
Yeah, yep.
I remember that year, which took their toll on a couple of the churches.
I mean, there was buildings. I mean, there was a St. Jacob's, I believe, that collapsed during the rains.
I believe so.
Yeah, it was St. Jacob, because yep. St. George, I think, is still standing somewhat. But yeah, because it's interesting you mentioned the rain, so I just want to touch on that, because in 2019, was it 1908? Yeah, where it rained so much, and I remember that outside the buffer zone, buildings had collapsed.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking at the time that in the buffer zone and in Varosha, there's going to be a lot of damage, and you would have been privy to seeing that. So it must have been, I guess that's where your attachment to the place would have come in, making you somewhat feel the element of the local, our feeling to things, because you'd seen it before. And you'd seen it after the rains, you know.
Well, these buildings that sit within the buffer zone mm-hmm. and either side of it are part of a shared cultural heritage. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter what your affiliation.
Yeah.
They are a really, really kind of rich architectural legacy
mm-hmm.
and cultural and urban legacy that is fascinating. And to some extent, that sort of sense of division in Nicosia, you can see it in the urban fabric pre-existing. The formation of the buffer zone,
yeah,
because of a historic city enclaves, that existed.
A lot of people don't realize that the island started dividing in the 50s. You know, I mean, people think it all happened in 74, but it didn't. There were enclaves well before that.
Well, I think there's even evidence of it predating the 50s as well. And I believe there was an aqueduct or aquifer that ran through part of it that you can see.
Okay.
Just correct me if I'm wrong. You're probably going to get a lot of people writing you to say, no, that's not correct. But you can see that there are sort of aspects that have shaped that urban morphology over time. But certainly the formation of the buffer zone was a radical shift and point in time.
It's interesting because I find that I learn about the rest of the island from the buffer zone because I spend a lot of time in rural Bafos,
mm-hmm.
and there's a lot of villages there that were once Turkish Cypriot, and some of them are used, lived in by refugees or new occupants, others are abandoned. Some of them, especially around where my father-in-law's village is, some of these villages had either been abandoned in the 60s or had become enclaves in the 60s. And you can see very stark boundaries around some of these villages where Greek Cypriots had farmed up to a certain point, and then it was Turkish Cypriot farming or not farming because they couldn't get access to equipment and fuel and whatever. And to this day, 60 years later, you can still see these scars on the territory, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think I would ever have noticed that had I not learned a bit about the buffer zone from projects like your own and others. And now, ever since Varosha has been somewhat opened up and accessible, I've been in and I've seen things that have made me understand the Nicosia buffer zone as well. So Varosha is not a buffer zone. It's a bit of a different story, but it does act the same way.
Yeah.
I mean, it's abandoned buildings. It's not occupied. It's left to the mercy of the elements. So there is a lot that you can learn from that as well. with your students in 2019, mm-hmm. what age group are we talking? Was this a wide spectrum or were they quite young university students? Or
they were masters students.
Okay.
So masters of architecture students.
Okay. So a bit more aware of architecture than your first years, let's say.
Yes.
I think they would have probably found the buffer zone quite fascinating because it is a snapshot of everything up until 1974. So, I mean, they're not 1970s buildings. They're not 1960s buildings. Some of them are from the 40s, 30s. You know, I mean, there's all different types of architecture in there. What there isn't is buildings built after 74.
Yeah.
And that's what's fascinating, both in the buffer zone and in Varosha, seeing a land that time stood still. But as you mentioned earlier, you have this snapshot frozen. It's almost like a museum. But unfortunately, the museum's missing a roof and everything's rotting to the ground. So, it's the best and worst of both elements of a museum.
Yeah.
You know, and I think what you guys did, and you'll need to explain to us now how it works, by scanning this, you create this digital archive of something that may not even exist anymore as we speak today or won't in the future. And so tell us a bit about the concept. Like this.
Yeah, so we part of what we've been doing in scanning each of the sites, and the sites that we have selected have been largely opportunistic, so sites that we have been able to get access to, sites that also represent a range of different scales and types of buildings, so that we were testing the scanning equipment and how to actually kind of translate this into a living, accessible digital archive. So, you know, it was a testing ground for us as well. So it's not like we were, I think if we were to, when we go back to scan more sites, you know, we would look at selecting those slightly differently now that we've done that first round of test scans. But from those, we were able to, we have point cloud files. So the laser scans it. We get a file that represents points in space, and from that is able to create a 3D digital image. There's a lot of afterwork and processing, which Mitchell would be better placed to talk to. And so we've been able to create 3D video fly-throughs from those scans, renders of moments or spaces. The scans themselves are really kind of... It's a fascinating emergent technology that you can play with the transparency of and the kind of the space between the dots of information.
Okay.
So you almost create this sort of X-ray vision through buildings or ghosted imagery. So in terms of representing a space that is contested, is one of deep memory and loss for many people, the scan as a medium through which to actually represent that and enable people to engage with the site, you know, despite the physical barriers that are there in between, the 3D scanning and the creation of the digital archive starts to dissolve those boundaries and makes those spaces accessible for the entirety of the Cypriot community.
So is it, can somebody, because I'm everyone knows is that I'm digitally unable to understand a lot of things. I'm not a techie. So somebody's able to put on VR goggles, for example, and take a walk through these properties?
Eventually.
Yeah.
We have not translated it into that yet. So it's something that we're putting forward as something we would like to do with the material that we've got for sort of future, that you could walk through significant portions of it. At the moment, they are standalone pockets of scan files. So whilst they're sort of fairly large buildings or tracts of the urban landscape, you could go in and you can rotate them, you can zoom in, but we haven't
actually created the VR walkthrough
yet.
I don't know, I think we're from the same generation. Do you remember Wolfenstein, that game?
You've lost me.
Okay. It was basically you could walk through a corridor into a room, whatever, just kind of look left, look right, look up, and that was about it. You know, it wasn't the fully immersed experience, but in the 90s, this was wow, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm just thinking that I can see the potential here for what's being created being accessible to people in the near future, where they could literally put on some goggles or just on a screen on a computer, have a walk through these places and interact with it. And I don't know whether it's keeping the memory alive or being inspired to protect and salvage heritage. But would I be wrong to say that you could use this same technology in the non-buffer zone realm?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we have the start of some scans of Salamis. So there are some sites that we have looked at outside of the buffer zone.
Yep.
Again, they are typically sites of you know, important cultural and architectural heritage. So we've scanned some of those, and the Salamis site, unfortunately, was cut short due to the weather, because with the equipment that we have, if it's low light or it starts to rain, that's game over for that day.
Which is not a common environmental phenomenon in Cyprus.
Lucked out.
Yeah, you lucked out on that one. No, look, I can. I'm very interested. I'm actually working on a project with some Canadian partners, mm-hmm. where we are introducing VR tours in museums and things like this, and it's got me interested as well on a personal level at how, you know, you can be on the other side of the planet and visit Salamis or visit Kurion or, you know, have a walk through the Venetian walls in Nicosia from the comfort of your home in Melbourne, you know, like whether it's for educational purposes, whether it's for touristic money-making purposes, that's just the business end. But yeah. The heritage salvation, I mean, I can imagine, for example, let's look at the earthquake in Turkey last year, was this time last year, a lot of, okay, modern buildings, modern photographs of them, sure, you can kind of rebuild them proper, but there was a lot of historical buildings, mosques, walls, things like this. Now, if you had these 3D scans and imagery of all these places, when it comes to restoring and rebuilding them, you could do it almost brick by brick, scratch by scratch, you know, as opposed to going by some old photos, you know. So I can see how countries around the world could use this technology to almost like a digital insurance, to have your digital print, digital recording of a site. So if one day there is an avalanche or a war or whatever and something is lost, maybe you can rebuild it, maybe you can't, but at least you have the digital imagery of it. And I think we're at that stage in humanity where we are looking at that technology, yeah. and you're at the forefront of it. I mean, 5 years ago when you were here in 2019, I remember being so super impressed by what you guys were doing. And I know that a lot of people saw some of your work because then you were part of the Buffer Zone Fringe Festival.
Buffer Fringe Festival
At the Home for Corporation with the Association for Historical Dialogue and Research, the AHDR. And I remember that got a lot of good feedback. Here we are 5 years later and I'm still talking to people who reference your exhibition there. Tell me a little bit about what you guys set up there so people can understand.
Yeah, so for those who weren't able to see the exhibition in 2019, it was a part of the Buffer Fringe Performing Arts Festival, mm-hmm. and what we exhibited was some of the student design work, and there were some you know, amazing designs that the students did that were speculative projects, that some were within the buffer zone, somewhere outside of the buffer zone, and also photography that Mitch and I had taken within the buffer zone on our trip, and then 3D scans. And we had as part of that a video fly-through that was a sort of video rendition of the scans and moving from different site to different site within the buffer zone was played on a loop within that exhibition. And it's one that we actually have since exhibited in Melbourne at the Centre for Contemporary Photography.
Oh, wow.
And
when was that?
You are going to test my memory. I think it was 2020 now. It could have been 2021, but it was well received. So it ended up winning an award from the Australian Centre for Moving Image for Best Video Work.
Oh, wow, from the ACMI.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, so it was very well received. It's one that we'd probably love to exhibit somewhere else if we were given the chance, but also to produce similar audio-video installations from the scans, mm-hmm. to be able to create affective encounters with the spaces within the buffer zone that people can really engage with.
Oh, that's fantastic. I mean, the application of this and the continuation, like what you just mentioned, having exhibited in Melbourne, winning an award, I mean, that's fantastic. That's really good. I'm really happy to hear that. I mean, okay, there's more than, I mean, I don't know where to start with this, but tell me now, you're in Cyprus now ever so briefly.
Yes.
Why are you here now? Because I know it's a little bit different to your previous visits.
It is. So, you know, whilst I have been doing some work this trip around the scans, mm-hmm. This time it's I'm looking primarily I'm here primarily for some other research that I'm doing as part of my PhD work, mm-hmm. with Cambridge University. and I'm looking at the design of women's refuges for domestic and family violence.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a case study project that is here in Nicosia that I'm looking at, and I'm heading to later this afternoon to speak to the service provider there. And that's whilst that particular body of research focuses mainly on women's refuges in Australia, I have a number of case studies around the world that have been written up in terms of the design of the refuge environment. And there are very few that have actually been written about on the sort of global architectural scene in terms of their design. And the one here in Nicosia is one of those. I have another one in Israel, Tanzania, Mexico, Sweden.
So what for the ignorance like me, why are we interested in the architectural element of a woman's refuge? Why? What's the difference between a woman's refuge and maybe, I don't know, a kid's refuge or a doctor's clinic? I mean, like, what is it that's drawing your attention? What are you looking at? What are you looking for?
Sure. So, I mean, because of the experiences that women have been through that have led them to seek refuge in a shelter, often they come with, a variety of health and well-being issues that are a direct result of living in a situation of, violence or coercive control. There are a range of sort of different spectrums of experiences that the women have been through. But they bring with them their own set of concerns. So what I'm looking at is how well the refuge environment meets the needs of the women and children who are living within the refuge, how well it meets service provision needs, and looking at longer term outcomes in terms of health and well-being, agency and autonomy, safety and security. You know, how do the women and refuge and service providers perceive the environment in terms of it being a safe and secure environment?
See, this is fascinating stuff. I mean, I'll admit that I probably would never have thought of the necessity to look at the architecture of a place like this. In my head, my first gag reflex is, okay, I need four walls, some windows, maybe some nice paintings on the wall, comfortable bed and a roof.
Yeah.
But if I think we're a little bit more savvy to what kids need, okay? We're used to the kids' realities. You know that when you go to a kids' hospital, you'll often see colourful walls. You'll see, I don't know, animal stickers on the floor. You won't have heavy overheads. You create an environment that makes the kid feel safe, calm.
Yep.
This is something I noticed when I left Melbourne, having been to, like, the Royal Children's Hospital and all these places, you know, world-class places designed for kids. And then you come to Cyprus and you go to a kids' hospital. They have improved, I'll be fair, they have improved. But I remember the initial times I visited them, especially when we had our first child, I was mortified what these places looked like.
Mm.
And I remember discussing with some friends and with some women's groups that I'm working with, where we said, you can tell that these buildings were designed by men for the client. And the client was whoever was paying the money, it didn't matter.
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, not necessarily that a woman needed to come in and look at the architecture here whilst, okay, a woman definitely can relate to themselves a bit better than a man can, but it was that stark ignorance to the realities of what is actually needed for the person who's going to use that space. In your situation, we're talking about now women that are seeking the refuge. They need a much different place to an accountant's office.
Yeah.
They need a much different place to a kitchen in a restaurant. A lot of people won't realize the importance. A lot of people think, okay, it's important that we have good psychologists there. It's important that we have good welfare workers there. It's important that they get a good feed maybe. My thing was, okay, I've got to make sure there's comfortable beds and safety, like security cameras. Then again, I've just said that and I'm saying, okay, would they feel comfortable with security cameras in the room if they've lived in a monitored environment prior?
Yeah.
If they were trafficked or something. So I'm making this up on the spot now, but I know and I admit that I'm not an expert on it. And this is where I need experts like yourself to come in and look at these spaces. And it's great that you're comparing not just Australia within Australia or Cyprus within Cyprus, but that you are checking Israel, Tanzania, Sweden. I mean, some of these will be best practice, some will be not best practice. So that's really good. And that's something that's beneficial for all stakeholders here. I am only assuming that you will share the information with the people you visit eventually. I don't.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm a firm advocate of sharing knowledge and not it sort of being held within ivory towers. So, you know, I have already done a series of publications and I'll continue to publish and disseminate my research as I work through it. But, you know, like what you spoke about with the children's hospitals, you know, there's a lot of information around design for therapeutic environments. Mm-hmm. In the case of the Royal Children's Hospital in Melbourne, you know, they put in the fish tank as a source of positive distraction and the meerkats so that kids experiencing, there's meerkats in there.
Sorry, I just did a face. I forget that we're not on video. There's meerkats in the children's hospital. I would fake an illness
just to go running around.
No, it's my favorite. It's one of my most favorite animals. I'm like, I hope I never have to visit the children's hospital, but wow, okay. Like,
at least there were when they first opened. They might have removed them. Because I do remember hearing something about the animals getting slightly distressed by the amount of traffic in terms of, you know, the number of
people. Because I know that in elderly homes in Australia, they take in those Shetland ponies. Yeah. But they took a Shetland pony into this one elderly home. I saw it on Facebook recently in Melbourne. I was just like, wow, what a great idea. I mean, like, if I was sitting in an elderly home, just sitting there bored out of my brain, that would be the coolest thing ever, you know. Sorry, we distract from architecture.
No, but I was just saying there's, you know, a growing body of knowledge around how to design those types of spaces and particularly with trying to get particular outcomes for different cohorts. When it comes to the women's refuges, there's almost nothing. And it's a fairly new building typology. You know, the first women's refuges as we know them came about in the early 70s. But
whereabouts do you, kind of countries?
In London is the first one, but then there is some contention around whether that was the first refuge. And then they quickly spread. So they're, you know, by the end of the decade in the 70s, there were women's refuges. I think there were 150 that had come about, I'm probably going to get these numbers wrong, just in East Anglia. And
150 just in East Anglia?
I believe so. Wow. So, okay. But I might have to
clarify that
and edit that one out later if I need to.
It's okay.
I think the point is that there was a rapid expansion in the number of refuges from the first founding of refuges. And most of them were started by sort of consciousness-raising groups, the second-wave feminist movement, and the need to support women and find them accommodation because there just was none for women experiencing domestic violence at home and their children. And you would think from the early 70s to now that we would have a wealth of information on how best to design these spaces and what works, how to support different cultural needs within refuge environments, looking at long-term tracking and outcomes of women and particularly children, because in the refuges, most of the people in the refuges are actually children.
Right.
When you look at the statistics. But there just really isn't that information. So I'm trying to fill that gap.
Why is there such a lack? Is this one of the – I'm going to ruffle some people's feathers now, but is that just because it's related to women and the world tends to care less about the needs of women and it tends to be a male-led world?
I am going to go out on a limb too and say that I think that that is part of it.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at research in areas that are specifically focus on women and children, there tends to be less of it, certainly within certain sectors. I think it's also because it's always a sector that has struggled for funding. So the sort of reports that you might get, you know, post-occupancy reviews, that sort of, you know, post-occupancy evaluations, et cetera, there just isn't the funding or budget for that sort of evaluation after something is built. You know, they struggle to get the funding to build it in the first place, which is just, don't get me started on that, it's a crying shame.
It's one of those, like, they get treated like beggars can't be choosers kind of thing, like, you know.
Yeah.
As in, like, you're lucky you got this kind of...
In many ways, yes. Yeah. And I think that, you know, the not-for-profit sector, that's rife throughout the not-for-profit sector, irrespective of who is being serviced by that. And then also there was a shift from, in many places, not all, a shift from open refuges where the addresses and sites were known to hidden locations.
Yep.
I am going to be a little bit contentious, but I'm going to say that shift, whilst it was one that was done because it was perceived to be safer for the women and workers within those refuges, has had an unintended effect of actually making them less visible spaces.
So harder for them to find them to begin with, or reach out to them?
Harder for the community as a whole to understand and realise that they exist.
Okay.
And maybe that there needs to be a continual evaluation of what's working, because what works today may not in 20 years' time. And so it's always a process of re-evaluation that's needed. But also, you know, accessing these facilities for research, I won't get into the hoops that I had to jump through for ethics to get clearance for the work that I'm doing. And those restrictions are there absolutely for a very important reason.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's something that should always be taken very seriously, but it does mean that it is harder for people to actually initiate research in the field.
So that's You floored me. I just, there's so many things I had not thought about, and now I know that I'm not going to stop thinking about. I mean, I know that, okay, let's zoom in on Cyprus, where we know that Cyprus has a rampant trafficking problem. Domestic violence is rife, like in many communities, but it's rife here, and it's also something that's... We're a community that promotes shame and fear-mongering, scaremongering. So it's less likely for a woman. I shouldn't pinpoint this on Cyprus. It happens all around the world. But, I mean, I remember when I first moved to Cyprus 18 years ago, it was like rape, domestic violence, trafficking didn't exist.
They're taboo topics, which is another reason why, you know, there's a void in the literature.
Yeah.
Topics that we feel uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you just think about the term that we use, domestic violence, it already in its name says that it's something that occurs behind closed doors.
Yeah.
We don't talk about what occurs behind closed doors. And so this perpetuates a cycle of silence and stigma and shame. And that's...
And continued victimhood.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, that's, again, one of the reasons why I'm really quite passionate about the research is about trying to erase that stigma and create a real understanding of what women and children go through and the type of support that they need. And let's get better advocacy and funding behind that. Let's actually embrace that so that you have better pathways out of domestic and family violence for those who are experiencing it. And rather than them thinking, I have no options, there should be a plethora of choices for people who are experiencing that so that they can get help. And that help that they get absolutely is exactly what they need and helps them then move on to, you know, a wonderful future ahead free of violence.
No, and look, it clearly sounds like you're contributing greatly to this, and I'm very proud of you on that. Just like, you don't need me to tell you that, but something I started this interested in your scanning and the buffer zone, but this is so much more interesting right now for me. So I'm actually really impressed and really looking forward to reading your PhD when it finally gets published. I don't know, is this one of these things that takes decades? Because I know a lot of people say that a PhD is like having a child, so.
Well, it is a bit like that. It's my baby that.
Yeah.
not decades. So there are publications in the pipeline. I have some that I can forward to you.
That'd be great. I'd love to read them.
I think in terms of praise, we should be really praising the service providers than the many women who have advocated for support for women and children experiencing domestic violence over the years.
They're working in difficult environments. I'm not just talking Cyprus, I'm talking globally. Yeah.
Globally, very difficult environments, overworked, underfunded. You know, they're there because they are absolutely passionate about it. And they deserve all the praise and
support. Well, they're unsung heroes, aren't they?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Look, I want to thank you so much for giving us your time today and running us through these things that you're working on. I think Cyprus is blessed to have you and Mitch. So, hi, Mitch, if you're listening. Have you guys working on Cyprus, on the buffer zone? You're contributing in your way to something so tangible, you know, something that's going to that's going to be left behind for the next generation. Hopefully things do change and it's not just going to be something they see digitally.
Yeah.
But if so, then be it. So be it. It's better now, better late than never. But also regarding your PhD topic, I wish you the very best. And I hope that when your PhD is finished, that you do keep doing postdoc research, because, you know, as you just said, there's not that many people doing it. So you're already, the dam is broken. So you're already in the industry. So, and look, Cyprus is very lucky to have you, first of all, acknowledging the existence of the island, engaging with it, contributing to it, and learning from it as well. So, I mean, Cyprus has the honor to hand something back to you. So, I hope it is. I hope Cyprus is teaching you something as well. If not, then you let me know and I'll talk to them. But look, thank you so much. And I do look forward to having you back on the program when you have moved forward a bit more. And I do look forward to seeing your next scans and I will.
I look forward to doing the next round of scans.
Yeah, so no, I do. And yeah, make sure you do come in summer when the sun is out, so you never get a cloudy, rainy day. But yeah, thank you so much for coming. I wish you the best for the rest of your trip, which is ending very quickly. Safe trip back to Australia.
Thank you.
And I look forward to seeing you down under in the next couple months.
Indeed.
See you. All right. Thank you.
Cheers. Bye.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.